when Venerable Sujito asked me to give a talk about how things began, how it began here, I was really quite interested because I've never heard this story, actually. And, you know, I sort of visited memory here and there when we're talking about things, you know, discussing this or that event. But I actually go from the beginning through, I've never done it. So, and what is more, I've made no preparation. So, and I could get the dates wrong or chronology and things, but I'll do my best. So, 1956 was when the English Sangha Trust was formed, principally by Bhikkhu Kapilavado, and who was formerly, and he had two names, and I don't know why. It was William Purfoost and Richard Randall. So, but I know that he had a wife whose name was Ruth Randall, and I never heard of any lady with the name Purfoost. So, but I do know that he was a reporter or a journalist and photographer, and that's basically all I know. I don't know how he came to be interested in Buddhism, but what I'm sure is that he was a man of considerable imagination and courage, and probably great romantic, really, at heart, you know, because he tried to do something truly exceptional, and which was to actually form a Sangha. There were basic four bhikkhus in this country, and to try and get it going, establish it. So the original trust deed that was prepared is the same one that was never amended, that the bhikkhus, the Sangha used today. This is for Amravati and Chithurst, to which the EST, I shall call it, is the guardian in a sense. And so I only know vaguely what happened. Yes, they got together four of them. They all went off to Wat Pat Nam in Thailand. They were all ordained. And then without any without any preparation, without a teacher, ill-prepared, in my view, to come back to this country, they came back and settled in. I'm not sure where they were, actually. I'm not sure, because they changed properties over the years. It didn't last very long. I think the Sangha, the basic Sangha of four, broke up within a year. And after a very short time, the only remaining members were Kapilavado and Panyavado Bhikkhu, who is still at Wat Bantad with Ajahn Mahabua, and he's been there ever since he left this country. I think, I don't know, I think that briefly Panyavado disrobed, or then robed again. Anyway, there was a break. Kapilavado struggled on his own for a number of years. He was assisted right from the beginning by Maurice Walsh, who first was a director and then chairman for many years. And in fact, the one who can give the most, I think, the most clear view of what actually happened during that time is Maurice. And I do think that, you know, he should have an opportunity to answer a lot of questions, or at least have a stab at this himself. He's an academic and a very good writer, and he should make a good job of it, I would have thought. However, I'll just sketch it in broadly to where I met Kapilavado. In those intervening years, Kapilavado got sick, And not surprising, some of the things he did, like, for example, sitting in sopping wet robes out in the snow in the middle of winter, trying to dry them off with the psychic heat, you know. And no, this is not a joke. He actually did this, extraordinary, you know, valiant efforts. And then he got very ill, and then he was replaced for a short time by the trust with what they then called incumbents, senior incumbents, which during that period was sometimes bhikkhus, sometimes not bhikkhus. And they got people like Sangharakshita, who was a bhikkhu of sorts, Ananda Bodhi, and then a couple of others came back for a while as a bhikkhu. There was a young man called Alan James who became Samanera with him. And Alan must have been really young, you know, must have been sort of 18, 20, something like 20, perhaps. And then I met him shortly after he decided to disrobe. And, in fact, it was so close to the time that he disrobed that on the first occasion I heard him speak, it was a talk principally dedicated to the reason why it wasn't possible for the Sangha to function here in the West. And this was a notion which was being put about at the time. There was a Thai bhikkhu, a Chao Kun, called Tirawamsa or Dhammasuddhi, who had a place in Kent. And a remarkably good speaker, fine, wonderful presence, and spoke superb English. And but there was something that went off, some scandal or other. There were quite a lot of those, really. And and then he began to talk about, well, he not only disrobed, but he also kind of supported his disrobing with this conviction that it was not possible for the Sangha to become established in the West. And it was an anachronistic sort of social order, really. This was reflected by, and obviously Kapilavada had been influenced by this or found a sort of echo in his own mind, and he gave this talk which I found rather poignant and sad, that after having made such an effort for such a long time, and I'm now talking about from 1956 through to when I met him in 1971, so yes, I thought it was sad, and when I later learned of all the terrific efforts he'd made to try to get it going, it seemed to me to be, well, you know, one could see that he might have some regrets, you know. Anyway, so that was more or less a situation when I met him. And I came to meet him not because I was interested in Buddhism, I knew nothing about it whatsoever. Nor did I have any particular interest in religion. I was working very high-pressure business. I was in the advertising industry and had a extremely pressurized job. And in the advertising industry, getting fired is par for the course, you know. So there's no permanence in that industry. And so, you know, and I was getting fed up of taking things like tranquilizers and too much booze and generally kind of propping up things. And And I thought I'd try meditation. And I think I was on the underground at the time, down in the station, and there was a poster, and I was interested. It says meditation. That was the headline. And then the rest of it was relatively small. And so I'd started reading that, and the train came in. So I never read the poster. But it stuck in my mind, meditation. So when I got home, I thought, what do I know about meditation? And I remembered reading a story about the Buddha, or Siddhartha, when I was about 16, 17. What I could recall of it was that he was sitting in a wood or an orchard or something like that, and that he had progressed through a series of states, and it stuck in my mind that he began thinking, well, maybe I'll try that way, and then what emerged was these series of states which culminated in enlightenment. So I thought, so I got the telephone book and I looked him up, and and it said the Buddhist Society. So I gave them a ring, and I said I like to meditate, and the only two people in the country who were teaching was Chao Kun Dhammasuddhi, I think, who was in Kent, and Richard Randall, formerly Kapalabhata Bhikkhu, who was teaching on Haverstock Hill in Hampstead. So since I lived in West Hampstead, it was, you know, like a 3 or 4 minute drive. So I drove straight round and knocked on the door. And he showed me into his little office, and very thin man, small, and with sharp features, and rimless glasses, I think. And he said, what can I do for you? And I said, I think I'd like to die, please. He said, a big smile, and he said, I think you've come to the right place. And so he didn't really say much else. He just said, well, look, come on Sunday night, I'm giving a talk, and see what you think. And then, who was it? What's his name? An assistant will give you some leaflets and things. And that was Jackie, forget what her name was at the time. Jackie? I think it was Scott. Yes, could be Scott. Yeah. Oh, awfully pretty lady. Anyway, I went on Sunday night, and there was this talk which, apart from the business about the Bhikkhu Sangha not being, appropriate for this time, which I didn't really understand. It's quite a long talk, and the rest of it I didn't understand either. So, and at the end of it, I've never heard anything like it. It seemed to me the most extraordinary, proposition that the Buddha was making. I'd read an awful lot, particularly about religion and philosophy and so on. And I never heard anything like this. Nobody ever said this. And so I put my hand up when he asked for some questions, and I said, is it right that what you're saying is that the Buddha says, everybody thinks there's a self, but the Buddha says there isn't, and it's all been a terrible mistake? And Kapalabhata said, yes, precisely. Yeah. And we didn't say any more about that. But it put me in an extraordinary, you know, it was like a complete scramble in my mind. It had a very remarkable effect on me, the idea that the very thing that was causing me all this difficulty that I was trying to protect and prop up and generally soothe, and feed, of course, wasn't true. And so I thought, well, I'd go and learn how to meditate. So that's what I did. And I went every day and at the weekends and tried as hard as I could, really put some time in. And then 3 or 4 months later, he died. I don't know quite what, some serious infection. And he was dead within a few days. And I remember on the night he died, which was, I think, close to Christmas of 1972, I think. Not sure. That I sat up all night and meditating and so on. And then I found something that I think Morris had written. I wasn't sure. And I don't have it anymore. About Kaplabhado's efforts to establish the Sangha. And I thought, this is really terrible, you know, that after all this, he failed. You know? And so I thought, well, I'm young, well, 40. Yes, that's young. And anyway, I thought, if I can, I'll make it work. I'll try and do what he really would have liked to achieve. And if all it takes is that you're alive and you've got some energy and stuff, then we'll just see, keep it going, see if we can make it work. But that was an extraordinary, firm decision. I didn't realize that till many years later. Because the decision itself survived so long, you know. And I've never had one that survived that long. That is to say, and survived the things which I really, wanted to walk away from, but couldn't because I'd made up my mind, you know. So then I went along and offered my services, and shortly after, well, a few months later, I was secretary looking after the accounts, and the incumbency had been taken over by Alan James, and within a matter of a month or two, he'd married, oh, sorry, I didn't mention that Kaplabhado, that Richard Randall actually married Jackie Scott, about the summer of that year, and he died in December, I think. So, and then within a matter of a couple of months, she was married to Alan, and he was the teacher, well, that was great because he was. There was continuity. I thought he was a good teacher, you know. Everything was fine. We got things going. There wasn't really very much money coming in, but we didn't get into debt, and it was okay. I was able to practice. I was able to use the meditation cells they had. And I was very enthusiastic about it altogether. And then what happened then was that two young men arrived. One was both medical doctors, both in late 20s, I think. One married with children, one not married. Their names were Dr. Clark and Dr. David Jones, I think. And they, because they were so bright and such sort of pleasant personalities and articulate, they rapidly became to a kind of center of those people that were committed to Vipassana meditation, which was regarded as a specialized technique. I didn't know, because I didn't really know anything about the Buddhist culture across the world. All I knew is because I encountered this particular place in Hampstead, was that this system of meditation, which was the one which how can I describe it? It is very systematized and also layered. And it never struck me at the time that this was a kind of obstacle course, and you had to demonstrate certain insights, and then you got a prize for it. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to me later to be a bit naive, but what the two young doctors did over that period was actually to really get in, give it a good test, and then to start to criticize it. And in the meantime, Alan and Jackie wanted a holiday. They were going to go to Thailand for a month or so, and ask the trust if the trust would agree to appoint Dr. Clark in his place and during their absence, because he felt he had a great deal of confidence in Dr. Clark. Later I discovered why, but anyway. So then Dr. Clark was giving talks. He's a very different kind of speaker. And moreover, he had rapidly abandoned this lay systematic vipassana approach to the gaining of nirvana, and decided that the only way to go about this was to become a bhikkhu. And so, in short order, he left his wife and children, penniless, I might add, and went to Thailand with young Jones, Dr. Jones, and got ordained. Dr. Jones didn't ordain when he got to the gates of Wat Pak Nam, I think, but anyway. Dr. Clark was there. I can't remember his first name. David? No. David. David. David was there for about a month or so. I wrote to him in the meantime, and then just before he came back, I received a letter for him that made me weep, really. It was so, you know, so disappointing, because he had abandoned everything he ever said, and he was coming home, but he was going to disrobe, and he was going to stand up and tell everybody what a complete mess it was at Hampstead. and he did just that, actually. Did just that. And he gave his final speech wearing his robes, and then went down and took them off. And it was really very confusing, as you might imagine, to everybody associated with it. It was just silly. And then shortly afterwards, and of course I had to kind of keep things in some kind of order, really. And Anyway, then Al and Jackie return to this situation, and I can't in all honesty say that Alan ever claimed this or that Jackie ever claimed it. But I was left in no doubt that they had returned from Thailand arahants, both of them. And this, you know, suddenly it was a nightmare, this was. And I simply didn't know what to do. And because of my responsibilities as a trustee, legal responsibilities as much as anything else, the only thing I could think to do was to look at the trust deed, which I'd never really seen before. In any case, we didn't have an original. Somebody had lost that. But and I read it, and of course, what its object stated very clearly that the object of the English Sangha Trust was the provision of a residential centre for bhikkhus who are, you know, taken full ordination, and for the lay people designated by the Sangha, and it said nothing on that. It was very simple. So I thought, well, if I'm going to try and do what it was that I started doing in the first place, which was to enable Kaplavado's vision to at least, you know, have a chance of coming about now that he was dead, it was that we should return to that. And so by that time I was a director as well as a secretary, and we had, I think there were a complement of six directors, of which Alan was one. So I called the meeting, and the only thing on the agenda, as far as I was concerned, is that I would read out the object clause of the deed of trust and ask everybody to vote whether they agree with it or not. And everybody but Maurice resigned. So... so... and yes, well, you know, and then of course I had to say to Alan and Jackie, I'm afraid you'll have to leave, you know, and that was a very upsetting and emotional time, because I really liked them both, you know, and I got a lot of respect for Alan, and Dr. Clark, I don't think I've ever seen him since. Or Dr. Jones. And then then I closed the place down, because there was no teacher, and it wasn't appropriate for bhikkhus, and as a residential center for bhikkhus, we didn't have any money anyway, I really had to earn some money and go to work, you know. So, and then, quite out of the blue, sometime later, and I don't quite know the date, because then the place was closed down. But we had two houses then, 129 and 131 Havistock Hill. So we closed the place down, just let it tick over. We'd have somebody to come in and keep it clean and put the heating on in the winter and so on, things like that. Generally, caretake it. Oh, there was a caretaker, that's right. He lived in the basement of 129. That's right, he was unpaid, and he lived there free. And then a lady rang me, whose name is Frieda Wint, who lives in Oxford. And she rang to say that her teacher, who was the Ajahn Mahabua in northeastern Thailand, might actually come to this country if he were to be invited, and that if he were to be invited by the group of supporters that she had got together. Could I make 131 Havistock Hill available for him to use as his place of to receive visitors and to give talks and to stay and generally be looked after properly? So I said immediately, I said, yes, of course. And I have to go back a bit, but the reason I said that is because after this breakup of the continuity of teachers at Havistock Hill, I began to write to the Venerable Panuwado, who had for some time actually been a senior incumbent for the English Sangha Trust, previously in one of their properties in Alexander Road, Hampstead, and then later at 131 Havistock Hill, and had actually taught there, giving talks and generally trying to keep things together for almost 5 years. He then gave it up, went as a bhikkhu to Thailand. He was a Mahanikai bhikkhu, and then he encountered Ajahn Mahabua, who is a very well-respected teacher and a member of the sect known as Dhammayuttika Nikaya, I think. And so he reordained with Ajahn Mahabua. So after all the problems and the place was shut down, I started to correspond with Panuwado with a view to getting some advice as to what I should do, really. And so I had 2 or 3 months correspondence with him, which was very helpful. And then this request came through to make the place available to Ajahn Mahabua, Panuwado, and one other bhikkhu, who's, I don't know his bhikkhu name, but he's known as Cherry, whose mother's birthday they were ostensibly in England to celebrate. And the fact that Ajahn Mahabua, I don't think he'd ever left Thailand before, was pretty remarkable, you know. But it was an extraordinary occasion because I'd never seen this before, that without advertising, without any kind of preparation, although I did do things, you know, I had some people I knew who made furniture and things for movies, and so I designed chairs, two chairs and benches, sufficiently, I thought, which would actually fit, you know, that lotus posture, and put everybody a little bit higher than the rest of them that was seating on chairs, because there was a dais. So I tried to make it okay, and I had them painted, sprayed, you know, this deep Thai red, you know, that like that, and I think one was green, I'm not sure, a very Thai thing, you know, that you make him feel comfortable. And did various things that I thought would be appropriate, a sort of little stage setting for them, and they arrived barefoot, and everywhere they went barefoot, bareheaded, barefoot, it's really extraordinary that you see somebody at Hampstead, you know, walking around like that. But he was very impressive. I thought he was very impressive. And then right away, the house was full of people, visitors, you know. And then on his first talk, it was absolutely packed. They had to turn people away at the door, you know. And his talks were translated by Panuwado. I felt enormously successful, and I was very interested in these monks, because I've never seen one before, really, except the brief period that Dr. Clark wore his robe, and But these seem like genuine, the genuine article, you know, the business. So, and I had an opportunity late evenings to talk to Ajahn Mahabir personally with Ajahn Paniwada translating. Well, of course, Paniwada had been actually 5 years with the trust, so he, you know, he was very conversant with the whole situation and what had caused the difficulty and what they might do and so on. So that was very helpful. Ajahn Mahabir didn't say anything very much. He was quite emphatic about one thing. He said, just simply wait till, for the right bhikkhu to come along. And that was really it. And I thought, well, that's very sensible. And anyway, it's easier for me, you know. And so that's exactly what happened. And then, I forget when it was, 1976, June, I think. I'd phone rang, and it was Ajahn Sumedho. And he was at the Thai Vihara down in Wimbledon, I think he was, then. And he'd been given my telephone number by Ajahn Paniwada in Thailand, who'd suggested that if he was needing any assistance in London, that he should give me a ring. And he principally rang to say, could you give me a place that's suitable for me to stay, because I don't want to stay at the Thai Vihara. So I said, okay, I'll send a taxi for you, which I did, and he was there in no time. And and in the meantime, we got Jerry Rollison to agree to come in and cook and generally look after him. Jerry, by the way, did that extraordinarily beautiful pastel painting, which hangs right just there, just round, of Ajahn Chah. He actually did that. He actually did it on the that Havistock Hill. Anyway, he came round to look after Sumedho, and I think Sumedho was there altogether about 3 days. I had work to do, so I had to go to my job during the day. But in the evening, I used to drive up there when we talked for hours, and really answering questions about what it was like to be a monk and what was necessary, and you know, to tell me something about the tradition and what was important. And he said, look, I want you to come to Thailand. I invite you to come to Thailand and meet my teacher. So I said I would, and in November of that year, I got on the plane and went. I knew where it was because I had an American Air Force map of Thailand, a very good one actually, and you can actually see where the Wat Bapong would be. So I knew exactly where I was going, but I had no arrangements. I turned up the YMCA and got up in the morning, and there was this note, and it was a message had been left overnight, and it was from a lady called Kunying Samsi, and she said I will be calling for you at 9:30, and here is your itinerary. Now, I had no idea who she was, and I'd never heard of her. And when she turned up with she drove actually herself, and she must have been only about 4 feet 10. I mean, she's tiny and very, you know, masculine, and, you know, a bit like a little general. And she was terrific. My God, the way she could drive in Bangkok, you know. This is somebody you can trust, you know. Anyway, we were off. She did tell me very little about... She just assumed that I knew everything. And we drove to Wat Bawaniwai, to see Somde Nyanasamwon. And she told me, this bhikkhu you must see first because he's very important. And he is in charge of international affairs. And in fact, Somdet then is now the Sangharaja of Thailand. And he was just learning to speak English, but Kuning Samsi was going to translate and did very well indeed. And I remember she had these half glasses, you know, like this. And she was very earnest. And Somdet was struggling and did not quite sure why I was so, what I had to tell him was so interesting. But basically what I did say that I'd come to invite, if possible, to invite bhikkhus to go to England to try and establish a monastery in England. And one of my main concerns, because I was aware of this, was that in Thailand there was this separation between Mahanikaya Nikaya, I think it's called, which is the largest group of monks, and the Dhammayut Nikaya, which is a very much smaller sect, and I believe it was established by King Mongkut. And the view was that the Dhammayut were very strict keepers of the Vinaya, and the rest weren't. And so that was the distinction between them. But I went to say to Somdet that if I was going to issue an invitation and we were going to follow this through, then I would like him to know that I would not be responsible for importing a schism into England, and that if they were going to come, then it was an invitation that made no distinction between these two sects. So that basically is what I had to say. And so the two teachers I was going to see was Sumedho's teacher, that Dzogchen Char, who was Mahanikai, and Ajahn Mahabua, who was Dhammayut. And they were both of, in my view, equal status in terms of reputation. And so there were a couple of formidable teachers who were across these two sects, which actually was a rather good thing, and politically, so to speak. And after that, Kuning Samsi then took me to the International Wat, which is, what's its name? Well, Pananyanachat, yes, that's it, of course it is. And we arrived at the entrance to the woods late. It was dusk, and it gets dark quick. And so she couldn't, being a woman, she said, I can't come in there, and you must go on your own from here. So just walk up there. And so there I was with my case, walking up into this forest monastery. Couldn't really see anything much, and I didn't have a torch either. But I could see little glimmers, which as I approached them turned out to be candles, and a vague shape of quite a big building, and which didn't seem to be quite complete. I wasn't sure. There was a side seemed to be open, so I could see these candles. And so I walked into this space. There were people sitting around, but I couldn't see anyone or make out any details. And stood there, and this deep American voice said, "Good evening." and then it was, George Sharp. I'm here to see. And then, of course, I said, oh, yeah, of course, it's Venerable Sumedho. Anyway, that was my arrival. And then for the next couple of days, I was able to go around the Watt and see how it functioned. You know, that you'd see, they'd show me how they chip chunks off the jackfruit tree and boil it up in water to make the dye. And every time you washed your robes, you had to dye them again because the robe leached out, the dye leached out. And then I met Pabacro, who was very skillful, great at doing macrame and making bases for bowls and what, you know, it's really beautiful work, I thought. He seemed very capable. Everybody seemed very capable of living there. And they were doing basic things like dig wells and what, you know. And so I was also able to see the relationship between the laity, who would come up from the village every morning to take over the kitchen, cook things, bring rice, and in fact, on my first morning, I took my shoes and socks off and followed them down to the village. I think I probably did the right thing, you know, but the pink toes and things and walking down to the village. It was pretty hard, but it was very early, and I remember I don't think I'd seen anything ever so beautiful as the mist over the paddy fields, the water buffalo. And then as we got close to this village where you've got these houses on stilts, and there in this mist were all these people on their knees, you know, like this. It's just so beautiful. Oh, you can tell I'm touched thinking about it. And that, you know, that was probably more important than, by way of a teaching or education than anything I'd had at Havistock Hill, really. I didn't, at that point, I wasn't really trying to ask questions or to analyze or talk about the prospect of what was going to happen if they did this and what. I just wanted to, you know, be around. I think a couple of days later, Ajahn Sumedha got all his gear together. The traveling bhikkhu, you know, the bowl and the grot and all the gear for the tudong. Mm-hmm. It's like sort of bhikkhu equivalent of being a marine, isn't it? You know. So I know, because I haven't seen anything like it in my life. And he said, we're going to see Longpo Cha. It's only about 6-7 kilometers, something like that, cross country. And we set off, and we'd walked for a while, and it was very hot, extremely hot. And we'd seen no one, absolutely no one at all. So we sat down at one point for a rest. And out of nowhere came this person with a tray with drinks on it. Absolutely astounding. Where had this person come from? Anyway, we carried on and arrived at... he didn't say this is Bapong or anything. We just arrived at this hut in the middle of the sort of clearing. And there was this little fat man, little fat bhikkhu, who... was standing, and he turned and looked at me and said something in Thai, and I didn't know who he was, and Sumedho said, this is my teacher, Longpo Cha, and he says you look happy. So We just, you know, we had a drink or two, and I didn't, because everything was in Thai, so I didn't know what was going on. It was all a bit, a lot to take in, really. And but I did get to meet a number of bhikkhus who were English, Canadian, American, so, you know. And so that was encouraging that, you know, I didn't know how many Westerners were actually monks in Thailand. I had no idea. So I thought, well, you know, there's obviously quite a few of them if this is, you know, one monastery, two monasteries, and I've seen, you know, quite a few because. Anyway, that evening I came time for me to, you know, turn in. There's no food, of course, because we'd arrived after the meal. And there was no, I didn't know where I was going to sleep, and nobody, Achin Chai hadn't said. And it looked like a bat pong, if Achin Chai hadn't said anything, that nothing gets done. So I slept in a deserted, on the floor of a deserted, I thought, you know, like a chapel, small shrine room or something. And then somebody came along and said, have you got any bedclothes? And I said, no. And so they found me something to put on. And then and another bhikkhu came and said, you've got pillow? You need pillow. Have you got candles? No. Anyway, they sort of gradually accumulated these things. And then when it came to morning, I saw Achin Chai in the morning and, briefly, but it's always activity. There was always people wanting to talk to him. So after it came to the meal, a very long Upasata hall, and it was full of bhikkhus, full of monks, and they had set a place for me on the ground outside the building, and I remember this what looked like a washing up bowl. It was very chipped, a mat on the floor, and my companions were the monastery dogs. and in any case, I couldn't eat the food. It was so awful. I tried, and then when I did turn up at Charles Kuti, he observed that he thought I was probably sick, and here was a hermetal remedy for whatever it was that was making me sick. But it gradually settled down. The accommodation didn't get better, and I still had to eat on the floor outside. We had talks, you know. He'd give me half an hour, an hour, whatever, to talk about these things. And then after a few days, we decided to travel to see various ajahns that Achin Sumedho wanted to introduce me to, and also he would show me other wats, and then finally we'd end up at Wat Ban Thad to see Achin Mabua, and which I was looking forward to. So at that point, Somdat Nyan Samwon knew what the deal was. So did Achin Chah, and then when I got to Ban Thad, so then I explained that via Banyuwada to Achin Mabua. Now Achin Mabua didn't like this at all, and he got very irritated by the idea that there was any possibility that the Mahanikaya could come together with the Dhammayutta, you know. And I explained that it's got nothing to do with me, and that I just wanted to make it clear that, I wasn't part of this business at all, and that if I issued an invitation, then I was not discriminating between these two things. And I liked him actually, but he was very rude and aggressive, and there was one time when it was late at night, there was no one else there, and I said to him, what was the purpose, what was the function of this being so coarse and vulgar and rude. And and he laughed and he said, this is how I am, this is my nature, I'm like this. And but he obviously liked it. And we got along fine after that. And and then anyway, then we went, the troubles actually took quite a while. And of course it gave me an understanding of the way in which the life or the culture from which Sumedho had emerged and arrived in London, you see. And so I was by that time I was more or less content that we should have a crack at doing this. And I knew that Ajahn Mahabua wouldn't agree. He more or less said, I won't agree. What he said was that, I'm not going to say I don't agree. What I'm going to say is that I am not going to tell any of my bhikkhus they can do this, or that they should do it. If they want to do it, they can. But I'm not going to be part of it. Which seemed fair enough as far as I was concerned. I went back to see Ajahn Chah and I told him what Ajahn Mahabua said. And then I said to him, "What's the difference? What's the difference between you and him? You know, and he said there isn't. He said we are the same in Vinaya." That was his answer. So and that was good enough. So I thought he might agree to having a go at this, and I think I suspected that he had a great deal of confidence in Sumedho. And in fact, at one time, Sumedho was translating, I said to Ajahn Chah, this is really quite a venture, and quite frankly, Venerable Sumedho is going to have a very tough time, getting this started. Now, I don't know anything about Venerable Sumedho, and he comes to me without any reputation whatsoever. So, but on the other hand, Ajahn Chah, you, a great teacher, you have a, you know, considerable reputation, so, and with such a reputation that this venture might have a chance of getting off the ground. So what can you tell me to give me confidence in the Venerable Sumedho? So, And Sumedho had to translate this. and Ajahn Chah said, I don't think you'll get married. So, it was terrific. Because that's what all these bhikkhus have been doing in England. So that was more or less it. I came home I'm skipping chronology, but I can tell this bit at this time because later, in fact, it's mentioned in Venerable Father, in that book, Venerable Father, by Paul Breiter, who was there as a monk when I was there. And we spent some time together in, I forget what his name was as a monk. Warapanya, that's right, yeah. And he used to have good coffee. And apparently behind the scenes there'd been some concern about how badly Ajahn Chah treated me, see. And I had no idea of this. I had no comprehension I'd been treated badly. And apparently people were telling him that Ajahn Mahabua treated him well. Right? And Ajahn Chah said, I'm not Ajahn Mahabua. And, But people thought I'd been treated badly, but it never, you know, I thought this is the way it is. I didn't expect otherwise. I did lose a stone, though. So anyway, that's more or less it. And so I was on the way back, and then I knew that they were going to come over, and that Ajahn Chah was coming over, and he was going to bring four bhikkhus. So effectively, what he was doing was bringing a sangha, and they were going to have a look at Haverstock Hill. He was going to make up his mind whether it was worth a go or not. And that's more or less what happened. He simply came in, took over the place. People, and again, it was unadvertised. And again, the place was full all the time. And more money than I've ever seen was coming in. You know, bagfuls of checks and cash and foreign currency and Australia. Somebody, there was actually a bar of gold. Anyway, in the end, apparently he said to Samedo, there was Viradammo, Samedo. I think the order of seniority was Samedo, Kemadammo, Anando, and Viradammo. Is that right? Yeah. And they were to stay, and they were to do the Bindapat every morning, and they behave like proper bhikkhus and not to make too many changes unless they were necessary. And in the meantime, when I knew that they were going to do this, so then I asked Ajahn Chah if he would agree for three of these bhikkhus to be shareholders and directors of the English Sangha Trust. And I explained to Ajahn Chah that the reason why I wanted this to happen is because I didn't want lay people to have power over bhikkhus. And that if I've had three bhikkhus on the board and three lay people, which is the maximum we could have on the board, which is six, and I was the chairman, then with my vote and the three bhikkhus, there was always a majority for the bhikkhus. And this was based upon my experience of all the business that had gone on with the trust in the previous years. And this backbiting and jockeying for position and having views and opinions which they try to drive through and get majorities for is commonplace amongst lay people. But at least I thought, well, these bhikkhus will probably agree with each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And Ajahn Chah agreed, because I put it to him. I don't know whether this is against Vinaya or what, but I think it's sensible. So he agreed, and that shocked quite a lot of people. They thought the idea of bhikkhu should be a shareholder and a director seemed to me to be very bad. But the fact that Ajahn Chah agreed sort of at least shut people up, and so that's what we got. So we got an EST that could function, and I could be assured of a majority on the basic reason why we were there, what was going on. What then ensued was that I never liked Haverstock Hill, of course, after that, and I didn't really go much. And anyway, there was so much activity and so much support and sufficient money and everything, they really didn't need me for a while. And I just wanted to see how things went. And of course, it tended to go just like I thought it would go, which was return to the typical Hampstead scene where, you know, like the Buddhist vihara is like, you know, an attractive alternative to the Everyman Theatre, you know. And it was like part of the Hampstead range of facilities, and had nothing to do with what would be a good idea to provide for monks, in order that you know, what they're doing is actually assisted. It was about this essentially secular notion of again, you know, spirituality and through meditation, and or at least that kind of experience through meditation. And so after a while, I asked Ajahn, and the bhikkhus were of course living in conditions which were making them, well, certainly Viradhamma was very depressed, and it was a bad place for them to be all crammed up together like that. So I asked Ajahn Sumedho if he'd like a holiday, and took him to Macunthla in Wales, and then while we were there, we had an opportunity for a week to just take walks and to talk over the original plan. And essentially what happened was that I put it to him, look, we came to do this, Hampstead's not a suitable place, let's go back and sell it and buy somewhere suitable. And he said, yeah, okay, let's do it. So we go back and do it. And of course then when he did go back and told everybody that we were going to sell it and find somewhere suitable, then it was a very ugly time, because people didn't agree, you know. And there was a lot of upheaval and efforts to change the course of events. Two of the directors on the board were making very considerable efforts to change, to affect the decisions of the board. And they'd got the backing of a lot of people who were in the, you know, supporters of the Hampstead Vihara. And so it was a very difficult time for Ajahn Sumedho, of course, because people weren't lobbying me for me to change my mind. They thought it was all my fault anyway. But what they were doing was lobbying to change Ajahn Sumedho's mind. So it was very difficult for him, and also the other bhikkhus, because people were putting all these views and opinions forward as to whether this would work or whether it wouldn't work. If you were out of town, people wouldn't visit, you wouldn't get any help, nobody would give any money, and it was a foolish thing to attempt. But we pressed ahead. We found a superb property in just outside Western Supermare, which had the advantage of having 30 acres of beautiful grounds, a house bigger than this, in much better condition, in very good condition indeed, and the longest boundary of this property actually was cheek by jowl with an area about stunning natural interest and a forest, and, you know, which went for miles, so it was wonderful. And it was only it was 200,000 quid, we could afford it. But such was the pressure at Hampstead that while we were haggling, we lost it. And you know, just like the chaotic condition, this is what happened then, of course, came out of all these chaotic conditions, because, you know, part of the chaos was that Sumedho was walking on Hampstead Heath and this jogger came up to him, Paul James, and started talking to him, and he got to the position where he had a forest and he was looking for somebody to take an interest in it, and there were these people who didn't have a forest and were very interested in a forest. Ajahn Sumedho rang me and said I should meet Paul, and so I did, and And then shortly afterwards, we drove down to Hammerwood, and he walked me all over it and told me his vision of what it should be, which seemed very, I don't know, he just seemed like I wasn't quite sure what, he didn't seem a very practical kind of person, and what his vision seemed to be, you know, very difficult to achieve. But anyway, I didn't challenge him, at least that we were here, and there was a wood, and it wasn't very far away from London, and there was a good train service and a decent road, and the road was going to get better. So I thought, well, the next thing, it's no good accepting it. He was talking about giving the wood to a trust, providing the trust would agree to some conditions of his, which I said I would if I could see the conditions, and he wrote them out, and they seemed sensible enough to me, and the kind of thing we could agree to. But I said there's no point in our talking about accepting such a gift without proper accommodation for the monk. And then that summer, it must have been summer, because we had a picnic, and I drove down with my girlfriend, and we drove into the woods, and in fact I saw it today, that huge chestnut tree, and we had a picnic there, walked through the woods, had a look at the lake and everything. And then as we drove out, because we went through the gate where Mr. and Mrs. Clark Hall live on the Bridle Way. Yeah, what's it called? Moorhouse Lane. And because I was out of the car because I was closing the gate, and I said hello to Mrs. Clark Hall. And she was clipping the hedge or something like that. And we had a little chat. She said, are you the new owners of the wood? And then invited us in for a cup of tea. And I said, well, we're not really, because there's no point in us thinking about having this wood, because you can't live in a wood. And we need a big house. And she said, oh, I've heard that Mr. Hadley wants to sell Chithurst House, which is, she said, I've not seen it, she said, but I know it's quite a big house. So she indicated where it was, which is so about as close as you could get to Hammerwood, with a house of that size. So she gave me his telephone number, and I went home. And then when I got home, almost right away, I called Mr. Hadley and said, I heard you were maybe thinking of selling Chithurst House. And he said, how nice of you to call, he said. How nice of you not get involved in local gossip. And so I said, well, I'd like to come see it. And so he said, well, come tomorrow after the service, about midday after local church service. I think it was the one at the bottom here. And so I turned up. It was raining. And that was, turned up at the door here. And he came out, closed the door behind me, and said, you can't come in. So I said, I'm sorry, it's raining. And then he said, no, he said, you can't look around. So I said, well, can I come in out the rain? Anyway, so we got into the porch. And then he said, well, you can come into the parlour. Well, I think he called it parlour, I'm not sure. Come into the parlour. And but he said, you can't look around. We came in through that door, and there was this passageway. Now, this passageway was about as wide as an average door. Probably a bit less than that. The rest of the hall was full of newspapers and magazines to about this height. And so you walked down this passage, which was walled by magazines and newspapers. And this passage went, it went to that lavatory, and it went to this room. And it also went that way to, you know, to the front door. That was it. And the rest was all filled with newspapers. And then in this room was, looked all right. It's quite, not a great deal different to this, really. You haven't done a lot. No, it was shabby, but it was habitable and it looked quite cozy and the fire was going and there was a young lady, and Mrs. Hadley, and a dog, and it was cozy, and we had tea, and we were polite to each other, and we didn't discuss business or anything, and then I said, well, can I have a look around the outside of the house? And so he gave me a brolly, and so we walked around the outside of the house, and I said, well, the gutters are falling down, and the drains don't appear to be working, and what sort of condition is it really in? And he said, if you buy it, you must take it that it's derelict. He said, there's no point in looking round. It's derelict. And I said, and dry rot? You've got to have dry rot with the drains like this. He said, yes. He said, but I don't think it's got to the roof yet. But what is it? 18 acres? 20 acres? 18 point something acres, I think. And of course, I knew the sewage probably didn't work properly. Everything. He was right. And I said, how many habitable rooms? And he said, I don't know about that. But, the real question is, how many rooms have got floors? So, really what it worked out, he thought, was it had 22 rooms in all, and that there was maybe four of them that you could actually inhabit. And that if you did something rather swiftly about the roof, you might make another two or three, you know, that you wouldn't get rained on in. But I liked it, you know, it's absolutely honest. I mean, I said, how much do you want? And he said, I want £220,000. And which seemed to be a very small amount of money, you know, for such an estate. And if I were to agree, then, Paul James would give the wood to the Sangha Trust, which was 100 and, at that time, 170 acres or something like that. Not sure. And that we will also get 18 acres of superbly positioned land here, together with a big house that even if you pulled it down built another place, it was a bargain, really. And if we could find the finance, we could do it. And in any case, the most important thing, as far as I was concerned, is that the trust couldn't actually lose money, because even if it failed, and the vicars had to go back to Thailand, in that economic climate, we could sell Chithurst House for more than we paid for it. So I could justify this move to the charity commissioners in any event, and so I didn't really have any doubts about it, and. We're standing outside here, and And I said, how much do you want? And he said, 220,000 quid. So I put out my hand and I shook his hand and I said, sold. So and it just seemed to me, I just said it wasn't, it was, you know, I knew it wasn't a mistake. I mean, it's going to be a mess, but it wasn't a mistake. And in any case, I didn't have to justify it to anybody except the charity commissioners, because I had full power given to me by the board to do this in order to cut through all that arguing. And then Paul James is great, because he actually drove me down to Chichester to the council, and we went, both of us, like right away the following day, and we went from department to department of the council checking off the searches, everyone on the list. And so we didn't have to have a wait for searches being made or anything. In the meantime, we got a solicitor in Midhurst who was putting together the contract. And because we were traveling from London to Chichester, on the way back, we got the solicitor to draw up this contract and have it ready, and submit it to Mr. Hadley. So it was, Mr. Hadley had a contract in a few days, and we signed 10 days later, 10 days after agreeing the sale. I went down to sign, it's a typically English village solicitor's office, and you know, it's like a set out of a movie, really. And Mr. Hadley, quite an old man, looked quite sick actually, ill, and he was so agitated. It was excruciating just to see him. He couldn't stand or sit still, you know. He was in such a predicament. And so I signed, and Paul James signed. And Paul had already made the gift of the wood, so that the moment we signed, we had the whole bit. Oh, the trust had the whole bit. And then, since that, Mr. Hadley, I went, and I said, what on earth is the matter? What is it? What's the matter? Are you ill? And he said, oh, Mr. Sharp. Oh, he said, I can't tell you. This has been the worst 10 days of my life. It's been absolutely terrible. I said, why? Why? He said, I have been pestered every day. I have had lawyers. I've had people. I've had people I don't know how to describe. I've had people with suitcases full of money. And they said, for the house. They want to buy the house. And they said, yes. Yes. And I said, for a lot more money? Oh, he said, oh, yes, a lot more money. So I said, so why didn't you take it? And he looked at me in absolute astonishment and said, Mr. Sharp, I shook your hand. So I said, whoa, now, isn't that something? Thank you very much. And it was an amazing thing to do, because the difference, it was apparently, I only heard hints of it, but it was, you know, considerable. And I suspect, you know, and I do know that whoever wanted it really wanted it for polo ponies and the proximity to Cowdray Park, you know. And anyway, so we got it. And I left the office of the solicitor, drove up here, got out at that gate at the bottom of the field there, and got my camera and came into the field, and it was very grey. It was like a sort of gunmetal sky. It's like yesterday, between the really heavy showers, and I knew I needed a shot of the decently dramatic shot of the house, because now we were in urgent need of doing something to tell everybody that might help us that we needed systems, especially in Thailand. So I wanted to get a decent shot. And I know it sounds like I'm making this up, but when I took the picture, and it was on the original negative, didn't print very well, when I took the picture, there was a spot, sunlight, and a rainbow came over the house, and I thought I did get it on film, but it didn't print very well on the brochure that we produced. So after that, I got on the plane to Thailand rather quick. Jeffrey Beardsley, who was a director of the trust at that time, also a solicitor, great stalwart director. He put up about 3,000 quid of his own money to pay for the printing of a very lavishly produced brochure, which was done in no time, and that I could take to Thailand. 3,000 copies of this thing to Thailand with me to see HNCR and tell him what I'd done. So, of course, all kinds of things were happening then, of course, because it was very complicated. In order to dispose of the major property of a charity, you have to have the charity commissioner's approval, and you also have to sell it by auction. And of course, while all this was going on, the bhikkhus they had nowhere, proper to stay. It was also so difficult that Mr. Umyit Saw, who ran the Oxford Buddhist Center, a very big house with lots of outbuildings, agreed to let the monks go and stay there while we got organized. And then so I went to Thailand, and I took my eldest daughter, Nicole, she was 18 at the time, with me, just because I thought it would be a great experience for her. And we went straight to see HNCR, more or less. And spent a lot of time explaining to him what had been done and what it meant, how much money. And of course, the difference between the money, talking about money in a third world country where there were 40 odd baht a pound, and talking about properties in Hampstead is of course enormously different. So, he said what you've done is bought a car and you don't have any petrol. And and he said, we got petrol money, but he said, you come talking in millions. And he said, we've only got thousands. He said, you're talking in millions. And of course we were, millions of baht. Just to function for a year. Because what I reckon that we'd need was something in order to develop the place, we'd need something in the order of about 150 to 200,000 a year to make it run. And we didn't need that immediately, but that's the kind of figure we'd need. And you should translate that into baht, and you've got an awful lot of money, and many millions of. I'm not very good at calculations immediately. Anyway, but what he said, he says, I'll have to come to England for 6 months to raise that kind of money. And it was very gratifying. Oh, there's a little sub story here. I don't really know whether it's true. I was told this, so I don't know whether it's true. But one of the directors who lost his job while all this arguing was going on, well, he got sacked, really, effectively, because he wouldn't agree with us. And there was two of them got the boot. And one of them had raised money from another trust in order to take himself to Thailand and Siachen Cha to complain about me. And he got there ahead of me too. But what was really, really sort of nice thing is that he left Buckpon in a huff because he'd been treated so bad. You know, they made him sleep in a disused place and eat his food off a with the dogs. And he was very offended. And